start this up, but I mean, we don't have to start talking yet, but I just don't want to miss anything.
Well, let's do it.
Important. Okay, let's do it.
Well, I'd like to start by asking you if you would talk for a little bit about what you mentioned yesterday, the dynamics of working together, coming from different backgrounds, and how that's been challenging and productive.
All right, well, I'll start. I think that Kevin and I have extremely different, what I'll call intellectual styles, and they happen to fit together really well. I'm very detail-oriented. I read everything all the way through from beginning to end and take notes laboriously. It takes me a long time to read a book or an article. Kevin reads very fast. He gets a big picture. He reads an enormous number of books and articles a day, but he doesn't read them in the same way I read them. And so it works well because he's reading out there at this level of the gigantic archive, and I'm beavering away at this level of the very tiny archive. And we talk to each other a lot, on the telephone, especially on FaceTime sometimes. And that gives us a way to keep up with where the person is. So in the process of thinking out the argument of any individual chapters, I would say that that combination of intellectual styles works really well.
Yeah, I would say I would echo that it's working very well. I would just make, these comments on one. I really admire Mary, and I admire her work. So I think it's really the collaboration. You really need to trust your partner, to trust that when they want to go do something, that it'll lead to a productive place. And I think it's been kind of amazing to the extent that we've trusted each other to move into different areas and to redo different areas when either of us wanted to do it. So I think the trust component and the respect component is absolutely enormous. The second thing I think is the idea that we really do have a common vision. There is a very specific phenomenon we're both very curious about getting a handle on. We both feel that it really kind of relates to Mary's prior work. It also relates to my professional background. Mm-hmm. And so it's just, so there's a common vision between the two of us. And then there's been an amazing revolution in technology. Like, I don't think we could do this project without Google Books, be able to go into all, I'm really good at research, like I'm kind of the graduate research assistant. I go in, I find books, et cetera, et cetera. So, and then, so the technology that is enabled by essentially Google and JSTOR and all the things that you know, I think has been amazingly important for us. And then finally, it's kind of life experience. I mean, I bring one set of life experiences and she brings another. We both feel we need each other to do the project. I would definitely not try to do this project without her. I don't think she'd try to do it without me. And so there's a real need as well as the first two. So I think that's kind of the key to the collaboration.
Is there any aspect of, or would you describe the dynamic as in any way different knowledges that require some kind of translation? Or is that not how you would choose to describe your different backgrounds?
Definitely.
I don't understand many of the economic concepts, or especially the mathematical formulations of those concepts. And Kevin has a much better understanding of those things than I do, so he's able to translate those things. Then there are certain kinds of terms that get used by people, particularly theoretical terms, even the ones that have come up in this last 2 days that Kevin is just not familiar with.
I don't know what co-production means.
Yeah,
I've never heard of it.
I told you last time. But yeah, I definitely think that we provide each other vocabulary and the theoretical concepts that wrap around those vocabulary that the other person doesn't have.
And I would say the other part that is, if I understood the correction right, from my own background, we use models in our business. So forgetting about theorizing them and conceptualizing them and making diagrams of them, I have a physical memory of working with people who were inventing them, creating them, and changing them, and being disappointed by them. So there is a certain, I would say, existential reality to the project that comes from that background, actually, that I think I bring to it, being able to recognize, wow, this is an important thing. People, I kind of call them treats, and that is when we come to a subject that may not be sound exactly perfectly correlated with what we're actually doing, but I know that people building models would find it very, very interesting. So I think that's a very useful part of this. And similarly with Mary, she has a, you know, a command of what to write a narrative is and how to, just how to do the project. I don't have the skills to write this book. I have the skills to partner in writing the book. And I'm learning the skills from watching Mary. So that's kind of,
Let me add one thing to that, which is that I conceptualized this project as beginning with me standing on one side of a curtain. And on the other side of that curtain, there are a series of expert knowledge claims, expert knowledge assumptions, methodological procedures, about which I know nothing because I'm standing on this side of the curtain. As we continue to work on it, I occasionally go on the other side of the curtain and I begin to take those assumptions for granted and I begin to see, oh yes, you're right, those methodologies do work. So I'm trying very hard to preserve a stance outside the curtain because most of the readers are going to be people who've never been on the side of that curtain. So I'm trying very hard not to lose a certain level of ignorance with which I started the project, or at least a certain level of skepticism with which that ignorance was attended, so that I can say, oh yes, now I see why general equilibrium theory doesn't need to have real data in it. Whereas my first impression was, what do you mean general equilibrium theory doesn't use data? That sounds preposterous. So I'm trying to negotiate going back and forth across that curtained off area so that I can make accessible to people who've never had Kevin to talk to, much less experience behind that curtain, what's some of what's going on there.
This reminds me of Mary Morgan's paper, also in our group, and her working through experiential and scientific knowledges and how they're very intertwined. It sounds like you're dealing with an issue that, if it's not similar in practice, is what she was dealing with, similar kind of conceptually in terms of different.
The difference is that when Mary talks about having sympathy and empathy and identification with her subjects of analysis, the women who experienced the glass ceiling, and we talked about it, that's very different from what we can have with dead economists. You know, we can't have a sympathetic identification with the situation we're in. We have to work much more like historians in relationship to those dead people. So we can have a willingness to enter into their assumptions without being immediately critical, but we can't really have that kind of sympathy that she's talking about. Because her current object of research is living people and writing about those living people. So I think that's really different. So Kevin's experience matters, but by and large, the experience of the economists we're talking about is inaccessible to us.
I have a couple of questions for each of you, more individually, though, Mary, I think you may want to talk about the second one that I sort of had in mind for Kevin. Mine for you, Mary, is how do you see this work either kind of diverging from or expanding on the direction that you opened up in the history of the modern fact? Because as we pointed out in the discussion yesterday and also the larger group, there's a ton in common. You're sort of exposing the fictions behind the fact and so on. And just, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about that because obviously people are well familiar with the history of the modern fact at this point. And Kevin, if this, I'm wondering, coming from outside an academic background, if this sort of theoretical construct, I guess, of knowledge value, and I'm wondering if this has helped you kind of see other registers of value and what those registers of value might be beyond the purely economic, beyond future value. You know, we did a lot of talking yesterday about what these various registers might be and sort of if that has either helped you kind of conceptualize the project or what other concepts of value might have emerged.
Should we go first?
I can see if, but you'll have to remind me of the question if I go. I remember it right
okay,
now.
Sure.
Let me respond a different way. I haven't found particularly useful this kind of grand meta vaporist.
Fair enough.
However, the collection of papers and people for me has been almost every paper has given me something very tangible that I think is going to help us write our book.
Fascinating.
I'll give you just several examples. So in Mary Morgan's paper, this concept of how the object of study, right, and the object of study got congealed around the phrase glass ceiling, okay? Very interesting. Financial modeling doesn't have a clear, everyone uses it a different way. And so in a funny way, I'm taking from her thing about, how to think about creating an object of study, setting up what its boundaries are. I found that very useful. I found in Jim's presentation today, the thing about the model, maybe the four thing, and attention marking and stuff, very useful because of, I don't quite know how, but it's kind of very useful to our project. I mean, it's kind of what we're writing about. We're just not writing about what he's writing about, but we are writing about that. And so on and so forth. In Sheila Jasloff's paper, this concept of, I'm not going to be able to do it justice, but I'll say how it relates to our project. Part of our narrative is going to be about how economics develops a certain prestige, and then because of that prestige, is allowed to operate in our economy that has huge wealth effects for people living in our economy. Okay? In her paper, you saw the structure of how when a knowledge moves into a political situation, how it can be either marginalized or effective. I found that little model of how she did it useful. And so on and so forth. I could go for every paper,
sure,
and I would find something, a little nugget for us. So I love the conference. However, when we got into the more, the word value means different things in different domains.
Right.
You can talk all you want about it, but the fact is, it only is relevant to me at the level of the domain that we're talking about. Trying to move over the domain and then say, because they all use the same word, there now has to be some meta meaning that we are now going to go find. To me, I think that's total garbage.
Okay, fair enough.
In one of my books, I talk about words like value and credit as being switch points between vocabularies that in the 18th century were on a continuum, but during the course of the 18th century split into two completely different ways of thinking about the world. And Barbara Herndon Smith has also written about this. John Guillory has written about it. So that I think that the fact that terms like value now seem to have some transcendental meaning that's over the disciplinary split that historically they have taken those two meanings apart, that's a kind of nostalgia for a moment at which there was a continuum of disciplinary knowledge that just doesn't exist anymore. So I also consider this philosophical search after a single way to think about value somewhat stupid. But anyway, to go back to your first question, I see this book as a direct continuation, not only of A History of the Modern Fact, but also of Genres of the Credit Economy, where I talk about how the two disciplines of economics and a kind of humanistic study of what we think of as literature split apart from each other. And part of that split is the creation and then tolerance for a level of expertise and a specific use of language on the part of economists that increasingly separated them from the rest of the people in the world so that we can't understand them any longer.
The inside and outside phenomenon
that's
from
right.
yesterday.
So okay. That book is an attempt to tell the history of how it has come to be the case that economists cannot speak to anybody else now, and people who do literature are now the most devalued of all knowledge producers, period. So I see the three books as really chapters of a single story. Now this is by far the most difficult to write because we are now after the historical moment at which I spoke the same language that Adam Smith spoke,
mm-hmm.
or even that Stanley Jevons spoke in 1870. The way economists now think about knowledge is no longer accessible to me except through this intensive training program I'm going through with them. So this is the hardest to write.
Okay.
And I would say I'd say two things that relate to that exact question. The way I view this, and I really didn't expect it to happen. I had a long career on Wall Street. It was intellectually incredibly stimulating. But when I retired, I did not think I would go back to those matters. I thought, okay, that was a nice chapter in my life. You had to squash down all your other interests. I have many other interests. And now I'll pursue those other interests. So it's quite a surprise to me to go back to these things. The great excitement that I have is that when you are in the system, when you are an executive, when you're presenting to clients, you're kind of like a talking head. You're kind of saying what's the right thing. And it's true. What you're saying is true. To have the opportunity to go back and rethink and frankly learn the history of what we were saying, the discourse we were using, that it all has a history, that it all traced back to certain ways. I just think it's fact. I mean, it's kind of for me a double. It's also a continuation of something, but it's really a continuation of the career by other means. So,
sure.
I wonder if you would describe, based on this segregation of the relevant knowledges in the disciplines and their inability to communicate with each other, would you say that in some sense the future of ethnography or a project like ethnography or history, anything dealing with a modern phenomenon, needs to be collaborative in this respect so that the knowledges can talk to each other? And then likewise, Kevin, would you say that it's valuable in one's life if you live in this kind of, are engaged in a very segregated space, to be able to re-engage? And how would you talk about, like, the communication and collaboration across this boundary that you just described?
Well, I think that if people in the humanities were willing to collaborate with people who were absolutely outside the humanities and outside the academy, they would learn so much. And so, yes, I think that the project that we're doing has gained immeasurably from the fact that Kevin has a different life experience and a different training. And I know plenty of people who collaborate with another person in English who works on the Renaissance instead of the 19th century. But this kind of collaboration is extraordinarily rich. Extraordinarily rich, I think.
And I would say from my own, one of my interests, even when I did have my career, was in academia. So I served on the board of NYU, on the board of Weill Medical College, at the Spence School. So I kind of love academia. So actually part of it for me is also an entrance into a world that is like you walk through doors in your life, you make choices. And so the opportunity to come back and participate in conferences like this, to actually just offhand hear these types of things, it's just something I've always been interested in. I've never really left that, and it gives me a way to open up that besides our project. So there's a kind of an extra benefit for me. Also gives me a great insight from the standpoint of having been a trustee, to see these same institutions from inside versus from the inside, from the externality.
Yeah, certainly.
Okay.
If you have anything from the list there.
If we could exploit your experience, I would like to ask if you could say a little bit about what you think the impact in a very daily, everyday practices kind of way was of financial models for the people who use them. Like, what is it? So in Fisher's day, around the turn of the century, when he wrote this book, how did it impact the very daily practices of people who might have come into contact with it, and how does it affect your life now, having been on, or when you were on Wall Street, the practices of financial models, how does it make you think or respond or confront you? What is daily life like?
Well, I think the direct answer is, I think to a certain extent, certainly from our most recent experience, financial models have made us all a little bit poorer. They really did blow up. Although I don't know if net-net, over the course of all of their use, they've made us poorer or not. But clearly what brought us into this project was the impact of hearing senior executives of major firms that had put in place major funding programs to create models and so on and so forth, say they were just too complicated. We didn't understand what we were doing. Right? So there is something about the practice of financial engineering, which we're writing the deep history, that then we're not writing the history of financial engineering, but you can't get to financial engineering without financial models. And it does have huge consequences for our social and cultural, it's the way we are today, the using of these models, which is it is actually a conjunction of a lot of things, of PCs, of computation power, there's many, many dimensions to bring to it, but I think just opening up the box and saying, how did this practice that we all take for granted now come about? Will be a very valuable thing for people to think about.
So let me say something about the beginning of the 20th century. Financial modeling, as we know it, did not exist at the beginning of the 20th century. Irving Fisher did not create financial modeling. He put in place some of the basic assumptions that then got built upon and incorporated into what began to be called financial modeling in the 1940s. So that's one important point. What Fisher was participating in, however, was a way of understanding value, which was made necessary by the creation of the giant corporations. So these are things like U.S. Steel and American Bicycle Company, and I'm going to talk about this afternoon. And these giant corporations were institutions that separated ownership from management in companies. And it also reconstituted ownership so that what people owned was part shares in a company. They no longer were a partner in a company or no longer a co-owner of a company. Now, they now bought shares. And so Fisher is partly responding to a transformation in the nature of capital and the nature of ownership and the nature of property. And he's partly participating in helping people understand that. And one of the things that these corporations had to do was to develop these very elaborate accounting systems that would enable them to produce objects more efficiently and to make more profit. And so you can see the kind of conceptualizations that Fisher was creating as being part and parcel of this transformation in the very nature of value that was occurring as part of the merger movement and the creation of the giant corporations. So all of these pieces of which Fisher's redefinitions are a part eventually come together into the financial model. Corporations were definitely changing the way ordinary Americans lived because more people invested in shares, stocks, than had ever before done in history. And they lost more money and they made more money and so on. So I think that the way to think about financial modeling, the best way to think about it is how it affects us now. In earlier times, there are pieces of it in place, but they didn't have the same, as it were, coherent and potentially disastrous effect that modeling now has.
I guess I kind of have a quick, historian's comment. I'm not so sure I'll try and formulate it as a question, but I am particularly opposed to economic history, per se, and I find what you guys are doing is much more a history of economics.
That's right.
In kind of a disciplinary history of science type study, and I really like that. And I think from our conversation yesterday with Lorraine Dastin and others, the idea of the archaeological approach rather than tracing things forward, as historians tend to do, I think it's a really just interesting suggestion. And I don't know that I really have a question behind this, but I think it's a really cool model for how to move forward with an otherwise sort of played out form of history. So, yeah.
Well, we haven't decided what we're going to do about the strategy of narrating it. But I thought it was a very interesting idea.
Very useful.
To make yourself impervious to the critiques of historians, which can be, somewhat fierce sometimes, so yeah.
To be a scholar is to be criticized.
It is. So true. So.
One last question, which should be short, and then about a half an hour, so maybe that will be a great interview. Kevin, on Wall Street, is it possible to know about money or about what you're doing without using a financial model?
No.
Thank you. Okay. Great.